This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello and welcome to Trumpet Hour. I'm Joel Hilliker. Last week, we talked about the fall of the English-speaking world, and we focused on Britain and Canada. Today, we will continue this discussion, really one of the most important trends in the world today, and a dramatic fulfillment of biblical prophecy. This is something Herbert W. Armstrong wrote about in the United States and Britain in prophecy, but we are much further along in this prophecy than when he last updated that book in 1981. This is the subject of our new special issue of the Trumpet magazine. This is our 32nd year anniversary issue. It's being posted to thetrumpet.com today. And as we talked about last week, America descended from the ancient Israelite tribe of Manasseh, and these other nations, Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, these are the modern descendants of Ephraim. The biblical prophecies about Israel apply to these nations, and most of these prophecies are for our day. We'll start today with a conversation about what is happening in Australia. This has been notorious for some of the strictest COVID measures in the world, but we're going to talk about a lot more than just COVID. We'll talk about the history of this nation, its connection to Britain, how this is being lost today, the nation's relationship with China, among many other subjects. And this is a conversation with Trumpet contributor Callum Wood. Then we'll talk with Trumpet writer Chris Eames about New Zealand and a very similar story that's playing out in that nation. After that, we'll briefly discuss what the Bible says will follow the age of Anglo-American dominance. Again, one of the most important prophecies in the Bible. And I'll finish the program on a different subject altogether, just a word about the James Webb Space Telescope, which is scheduled to launch just 2 days from now. So, let's start in Australia. This country's first settlers were a hardy bunch traveling halfway across the globe to a hot island continent and making a remarkable success of themselves. But a number of factors have turned this former British colony into perhaps the most restrictive nation in the English-speaking world. A lot of Australians say they hardly recognize their home country. To talk about this, we have from our office in Australia, Trumpet contributor and native Aussie, Callum Wood. Hello, Callum.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. So let's talk about your country's history and what you see, based on that history, what you see as the defining characteristics of Australia and the Australian people.
Well, it's Australia certainly had a very tough history. They certainly didn't have it easy in the early days, being that the first settlers to come over were more prisoners than pioneers. But Australia, as most people would perhaps know, was a penal colony for the British Empire at first, and so a lot of the hardened criminals would be brought over this way. But what a lot of people don't tend to focus on is the fact that after they served out their sentence, a lot of those prisoners did become pioneers. They were released. They oftentimes received land or started to work the land. And some went on to be incredibly wealthy farmers and businessmen here in Australia. And so what you had was a gradual metamorphosis from a very desolate and dry country that hadn't been worked by the Aborigines beforehand to a nation that was cleared. The trees were cut down. The farms were tilled, the soil was turned over, and piece by piece, Australia was turned from this very arid and empty land into a nation that had value, it had worth. And of course, as the immigrants came across, a lot of Europeans seeking to get away from the problems they faced in Europe would see the lucky country or the land down under as a great opportunity, a place for people with an adventurous spirit, people who wanted to start a new life, started to look at Australia not as just a place where you could send your criminals to, but a place to go for a chance to make something of yourself and to get away from the turmoil and the problems that the rest of the world was facing.
So those characteristics that you're describing, this kind of can-do spirit and willingness to strike out, to be adventurous, all of those types of things, you feel like that really has characterized Australia's history as these prisoners have become pioneers?
I certainly think so. I think there's obviously a lot of factors that tie into it and sort of this conglomeration that's come together to form what we know today as the Aussie spirit, or what we did know, I guess, would be more to the point, as the Aussie spirit. It was the Aussie larrikin, the battler. You know, he was a hard worker. He tended to laugh and was somewhat reckless, you could say, in the face of danger. And of course, there are downsides to that reputation that Australians have had, with perhaps a bit of a rebellion against authority, against the British Empire at times, but also a love for it, you know, and a willingness to stand up and fight for what's right, as we often saw in history, especially in the World Wars.
Well, so that connection to Britain really is something that Australians have taken a certain amount of pride in over the generations. How do you see that changing more recently?
Well, it has changed a lot, and as you mentioned, it is a recent change. There was a time when Australians fought and died under the Union Jack, under the British flag. But what we've seen in recent years, and perhaps they're signs of a deeper change, we've seen calls to change the national anthem. We've seen calls to change the Australian flag. And in and of themselves, perhaps they're small things, but you start to put all the pieces together, and what you see is a nation that's distancing itself from its history. Now, the British Empire used to be everything. The British Empire was everything to Australia. You know, that was who we were. You know, that for the longest time, Australia was British. You know, it was British rule, and there was that deep love and a respect for the monarchy. Even now, if you go out to a small community hall in the middle of country Australia, and you have the old halls, and often up on the wall you'll see the Roll of Honour, where all the men fought and died for their country in the World Wars, but you'll also see a picture of the Queen hanging up. Mm-hmm. And you see it in the old halls, you see it in the old government buildings and such, but what you really don't see is that same love of empire, that same passion and drive for the monarchy. You don't see it in the next generation that's coming through now. There's certainly a love for the Queen, but I don't think it's a love for the monarchy. You know, for most Australians, the Queen is what they associate with when they think of the British royal family. The Queen is the one who's always been there. She's always ruled on the throne throughout the lives of most of the young generation here in Australia. And so,
young generation, you know, being anybody 70 years and younger.
She's been around a long time, Her Majesty. And as a result, perhaps a byproduct, you could say, of that is that people's love for the monarchy or even for any remnants of the British Empire are tied to her. Mm-hmm. And so take her out of the equation and there is no link. There's no tie. There's no passion and love for that throne or love for that history even. We see it in the schools today. There's even growing up, when I went to school, there was very, very limited history of the British Empire ever taught. Even Captain Cook and the founding or the discovery of Australia was very briefly touched on if we ever did history at all in schooling. And what was focused on instead was Aboriginal history. Now, they did have history here in Australia, there's no doubt about it. But as far as our ties to the empire and what did make Australia great, there simply wasn't any education on that. And the result is you have multiple generations now who just have either grown up with a very limited understanding of their history or a hatred for it. And the British Empire has come to be seen as oppressive and a stain on our history rather than the glorious and the wonderful thing that it was, bringing education, bringing literacy, bringing civilization to this side of the world.
So if a great deal of Australia's heritage, its makeup has had that foundation on British history and the British Empire, and that is disappearing, what do you see taking its place as a younger generation tries to define what it means to be Australian?
Well, what we see taking its place, I guess, is something of a sense of ignorance, or if you have no history, then all you have is the opportunity to live in the moment. Without any history, then Australia really doesn't have a charted way forward. And as a result, we see ourselves, you know, not bound to our historic alliances. And what that means is instead of, you know, building relations with the US, with Britain, with our historic allies, we instead turn to the likes of China, who don't have our best interests at heart, who want to take what we have to offer and take it at an unfair deal and use it to their advantage, which we're seeing time and time again. You know, that's one aspect, I guess you could see. The other is the distraction. Without our history, without the purpose that the British Empire gave us, without more noble and lofty goals for our nation, without feeling that Australia gave something to the world, that we were part of something bigger than ourselves, then naturally Australians, we tend to focus inward. And anyone who would live here would readily agree with me that Australians, we're addicted to distraction. We love our sports. Sport is the religion here in Australia now. Mm. And so long as people have their cricket or their football or their rugby, whatever it might be, so long as Australians have that distraction, then we don't have to think about what's going on in the broader world, the global community. You know, if so long as we have our beaches and our sun and a few freedoms here and there, and not many as the last few years have taught us, but so long as there's a few creature comforts, then the Australian spirit tends to work against us a little bit. You know, the Australian spirit its hallmark statement is, well, she'll be right. In other words, you know, it'll all work out. Everything will be okay. It's gonna work out fine. It's a somewhat of a cavalier attitude, I guess, but it served us well in difficult times. But unfortunately now, without our links to the past, without a way forward, she'll be right mentality just turns Australia inwards. We don't think about China's rise because she'll be right. It'll all work out. Nothing to worry about here. You know, without that purpose and drive, we don't feel a connection, a strong connection to our allies and a strong connection to what's going on in the broader world. And the things that are going on threaten our way of life. They threaten our livelihood and they threaten individual lives here in Australia. And yet, you know, we shrug it off because, well, we can put it off till tomorrow if we've got, you know, sport, or if we've got, you know, local entertainment or whatever it may be, the outdoor lifestyle that we enjoy. A lot of those blessings are now really becoming curses.
So there's a confluence of factors that you touched on there with Australians kind of letting go of what has made them Australian and just a lost sense of identity. And at the same time, pursuing a relationship with China, you mentioned that China does not have Australia's best interests at heart. What is the effect of this relationship, and how do you see China's infiltration into Australia affecting the country?
Well, that's that's certainly a very broad answer I'm going to have to give you, because as China has influenced every facet of our society here, from the top levels of politics all the way down to the individuals who have to deal with the effects. And I guess we could start at the top. So up until 2017, Australia allowed for international political donations. Now, it doesn't sound like, you know, the most earth-shaking policy, but what that allowed for is, you know, Chinese billionaires who are effectively members of the Chinese Communist Party to come along and to give millions upon millions of dollars to Australian politicians. And the result is very pro-China policies. Now, that's why we've seen China being able to purchase so much Australian infrastructure and so much land. Frightening of those purchases are things like the Port of Darwin up on our northern coast there. China has that for 100 years, a 100-year lease on a port. And the same with the Port of Newcastle on our east coast, you know, the biggest coal port in the southern hemisphere, vital to China's Belt and Road Initiative. You know, they have that for 100 years. They have a 40% stake in the Port of Melbourne. They own our largest dairy farms, our largest cattle farms. They own a lot of the mining, the forestry, the industry, even some of our electrical grid is owned by the Chinese. And it's so frightening to think of what that can do to the Australian economy and what that does to our national security. I mean, you could never imagine Australia going out and purchasing a Chinese port, you know, or buying the Chinese electrical grid. But yeah, here we've allowed China to do that, and it's been because of our politicians. A lot of those politicians who signed off on these deals over the years, when they leave office, when they leave politics, they actually go and work for these companies, these Chinese companies. Wow. And so, you know, thankfully the political donations have come to an end. They've put a stop to it after some media reports highlighted how dangerous this was. But unfortunately, the damage has been done. Right. Australia has linked itself to China in such a way that we are tied to their economy. They're our biggest trade partner now, and so that gives China enormous advantage over us. And one of the big areas is real estate. That's another one that we talk a lot about, China's trade deals with us, and how much we rely upon them and how much, you know, we have to sell to them to keep our economy going. But even real estate is another big one. In 2008, when America collapsed, when the housing market collapsed and the bubble popped, well, Australia's didn't, because we had the Chinese middle class, who are very rich. They're certainly rising, they're growing in numbers. They purchase property here in Australia at exorbitant prices. And so what we're seeing is, when the American housing market fell, the values fell on their homes, Australia's kept on rising, which means that now, if the same thing happens again, which in all likelihood it will, when the bubble bursts, Australia really is going to have twice as far to fall as it would have done in 2008. So again, at the time, it seemed great that the Chinese were buying up our homes, that they were buying everything we could pull out of the soil, that they were trading with us so much, and yet it is not in our best interest long term. And we can look at other nations around the Pacific where China is doing the same thing. New Zealand was a victim of this. China was buying up all of their milk powder, and then one day they just stopped buying it. Now, the New Zealanders didn't know that was going to happen, and as a result, farmers were going out buying new tractors, buying new farms. When their major buyer suddenly stops without warning, well, then these farmers were laden with all these debts they couldn't pay. The farms had to be sold, and who bought them? The Chinese.
Now, you're stealing Chris Eames' thunder a little bit. We're going to talk to him a little bit later in the program. it is the same story that's playing out there in New Zealand. Now, these advantages that China has gained because of politicians making decisions favorable to the Chinese, have you seen China calling in its favors? Have you seen them exerting political leverage over Australian leaders?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, it all boils down to the South China Sea. It boils down to Taiwan. And they've really shown they've threatened Australia in numerous ways. You know, for instance, Australia, we went to the United Nations and called for an inquiry into the origins of coronavirus and China's role in that. What did China do? Well, all of a sudden they slapped tariffs and they slapped bans on Australian imports. Australian seafood was left to rot at airports because it couldn't be taken into China. Suddenly China discovered all sorts of insects and bugs and pests within our timber products, and they found problems with our meat industry. And all of a sudden China just flat banned a bunch of butchers, a bunch of our products that we import, our barley, our wheat. They slapped enormous tariffs on it. And of course, that hurts Australia in a very big way.
And all so because China, of an inquiry, all because of someone who was just asking questions into coronavirus's origins.
Well, that's right. You know, if Australia, they were basically saying, if you dare to poke at us or come at us, we have 1,000 ways from Sunday to make you pay. And you know, now magnify that to situations that are boiling on our borders right now. You know, what if China invades Taiwan? You know, what does Australia do? Because, you know, if we're so beholden to China for our country to even run, well, then how effective can we be in pushing back at them if something were to happen in the South China Sea? Or how can we push back against China in the Pacific, you know, when they're bribing officials, when they're buying up property and infrastructure all across the Pacific, all around Australia? How can we push back against that effectively when we have they really have us over a barrel. They have so much power over us. The AdBlue crisis is a big example. China can shut down the Australian economy just by preventing the sale of that urea phosphate, by preventing that from going out from China. Suddenly, half of our diesel trucks around Australia that need AdBlue to run, suddenly they're stuck. Suddenly they grind to a halt. And so, again, it's just one example, but China has so many ways to severely damage or cripple our economy.
So Australia has kind of gotten a certain amount of notoriety or infamy across the world because of some of the draconian measures that your state premiers have imposed on the people. Just talk about your view of what has happened, and if you wouldn't mind, a little speculation on why you think Australians have given into this to the degree that they have.
It is an interesting question, and it seems like here in Australia the problem has been from the top down, of course. Now, when the COVID quote unquote crisis began, our leaders at the very top, our Prime Minister Scott Morrison, he deferred a lot of the decision making to the premiers. Now, the premiers are like your governors over there. They run the states, the individual states around Australia, and so a lot of the decision making and the policy was left to them. Now, without national consensus, what that has led to is a lot of these leaders now just making the most radical and really insane policies. And draconian policies, as you said, and each state is different. And I think the problem is compounded over the last 2 years, because if there's one thing that politicians don't like, it's to admit that they're wrong. Now, all these policies are failing. They're clearly not working at all. And yet, for the politicians to come out and reverse them would be to say, well, the last 2 years, I've had you locked up in your home for nothing. And so it's never going to happen. And so instead, what we're seeing is these premiers, each one is trying to outdo the other. And there's no science behind the decisions. They've brought back in the mask mandates, and they said, we're not going to lift it until 90% of people are vaccinated. Again, just completely disregarding the science, disregarding the effectiveness of masks, disregarding the fact that at 80% vaccination, we should see less numbers, yet we're gradually seeing more and more people catching coronavirus. And so the illogical nature of it just feeds on itself. To answer the second part of your question, well, you know, why have Australians let this happen? It's hard to say. You know, I think that at first, there were a lot more Australians who fought back against it. And I think over time, some have probably been worn down by the fear. I know people, I've known neighbours in recent times who I've spoken to, and 2 years ago they were on board and said that, look, this whole thing is just a government power grab. This whole thing is an effort for them to implement draconian law and to take on all sorts of powers they've never had before. But then 2 years later, they're tune has changed, and oh no, it's all about we have to be vaccinated, we have to be safe. So I do think some people have bought into the fear, but I think the other reason people have gone along is fear of the punishment. It's not fear of the vaccine, it's not fear of catching coronavirus, it's fear of what the state will do to them. We've seen police kicking and beating old ladies in the streets, spraying them point blank range with pepper spray. We've seen rubber bullets used on peaceful protesters. The first time rubber bullets have even been used in Australia on a protest. We saw that in Melbourne this year. And what we're seeing is a police state. We're seeing police brutality, and it's unfortunate. We want to stand up for law enforcement and have a great deal of respect for them. But unfortunately, it seems like so many now have just become an arm of the state. And, you know, we again see the power is being given to premiers to make these calls and to do these things. And so I think it's generated a lot of fear, not just of coronavirus or, you know, the vaccine. It's a fear of what the state will do to them. And then we have these mandates now, no jab, no job. A lot of people working in the medical industry or in schools, and now it's being extended to restaurants, pubs, clubs, cafes. A lot of people, they can't go to these places if they're not vaccinated, or they can't work there if they're not vaccinated. And so if you're an Australian and that's your way of life and that's what you've grown up with, that's your livelihood, or let's say, you know, you go to the pub with your mates every weekend and suddenly that's taken away from you, then I think people are more afraid of that. They're more afraid of the government and what the government can do to them than they are of vaccination.
We're about out of time here, Callum, but how do you view this from the standpoint of the Bible's prophecies for Australia?
Well, Australia is as we know, it's part of the was a part of the British Empire, and our descendants are the same descendants from Britain, which, as we know, and as the trumpet is often spoken of, is the tribe of Ephraim from ancient Israel, the tribe of Ephraim who migrated north and up through into Europe and into Britain. Well, they eventually, of course, travelled around the world to Australia too, in those first prisoners and convicts. And so, you know, when we watch Australia, we can certainly tie it to Bible prophecy. We can see that Australia is Ephraim, and the promises that God made to Ephraim apply to Australia as much as they do to Britain and the Commonwealth nations. And the curses do as well. And God warns that he says that Ephraim would be a silly dove. And when we look at Australia at the moment, we see that silly dove. We see silly decisions. And meanwhile, the nations around us in the East and elsewhere, God describes them as beasts. He describes them as bears, as leopards, as dragons, and all sorts of ferocious animals. And yet he describes Ephraim as a silly dove. And that's really the position we find ourselves in now. We find ourselves with radical leaders, but who make ridiculous and foolish decisions that might serve them at the moment, but will serve the powerful and the dangerous dictatorial nations in the region in the long term.
All right, well, we sure appreciate that. We've been talking with trumpet contributor and native Aussie, Callum Wood, about the fall of Australia, part of the larger story of the fall of the English-speaking world. He's written an article for the coming print edition of The Trumpet, a very special issue, our anniversary issue. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. His article should be up there today. Thanks so much, Callum.
Thank you for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Now over to Australia's neighbor, New Zealand. In many ways, the same story is playing out in this Ephraimite nation. To talk about this, we have from our office in Jerusalem, trumpet contributor and native Kiwi, Chris Eames. Hello, Chris.
Hello, nice to be here.
It's great to be talking with you. So talk about New Zealand's history with Britain and just how closely allied these nations have been historically.
Well, the key date for New Zealand's link with Britain is 1840. That's when the big treaty happened, the Treaty of Waitangi, and New Zealand came under the British Crown. Now, there had been links before then, but especially from that year and forward, and it was quite significant that New Zealand was incorporated into the British Empire by a treaty. This is quite different to how a lot of other historical empires have done it, with straight into war and bloodshed. And so that was something really unique about the way that the British Empire tried to expand, that it was in many ways with treaties. And from that time forward, you really had an explosion of growth in New Zealand. You have a very similar climate to what was back in Britain, and all the rich resources as well. So you had a lot of people immigrating to New Zealand from the British Isles, taking advantage of that. And New Zealand is an outlying island as well, so it's not so powerful of and by itself, and it relied on trade with Britain, it relied on supplies from Britain, a lot of its arms from Britain, and a lot of its funding from Britain. And so you have a really close relationship between New Zealand and Britain, of course, right from the get-go, but only developing as time goes on. You can lump in Australia with that as well. A really close relationship there for a good century, right through World Wars One and Two. In that case, you have right off the bat New Zealand joining with Britain from day one when Britain declared war on Germany. New Zealand was right there doing the same thing that very day. So these countries were wedded. There was a real sense of pride, duty and service in New Zealand back then, service to the motherland. And so New Zealand was right at the front, standing up to serve in those wars when Britain needed her.
So that connection and the pride that New Zealanders had in their connection with Britain, that has changed considerably. And why do you think that is? What led to the change there?
Well, to illustrate this point more clearly, I'm reminded of something my father said to me a while ago that shows just how much things have changed. Now, my dad was born in the late 50s, and he remembers going to the theatre as a boy, and before the show would begin, everyone would stand and sing God Save the Queen. That's the British national anthem. It's also one of New Zealand's two official national anthems. And for me, that's totally alien. You would not dream of anything like that nowadays. And that's just a few short decades on, this complete change and separation of ties, really, with Britain. I think a recent poll showed nearly 50% of New Zealanders wishing to be rid of the monarchy and to become a republic. But a lot of that change took place in the 70s. So jumping back a little bit before then, you have the pro-decolonization movement in Britain post-World War II. You've got Clement Attlee's government in Britain really starting to step back from their empire, from their responsibilities around the world, and becoming a lot more Europe-focused. And so you have this stepping back, this new focus toward joining the European Union, then called the EEC, the European Economic Community. And this all came to a climax in 1973, when Britain joined the EEC, the EU. And that absolutely wreaked havoc on New Zealand. Britain had been New Zealand's far and away biggest trade partner. The island relied on its link with Britain for survival, the way that it was set up, survival economically. And now Britain goes and joins the EU. And the EU, or the EEC back then, actually imposes all of these strict quotas, these restrictions on trade outside the bloc. All Britain's previous trade agreements with New Zealand had to be scrapped. Now, New Zealand used to be called Britain's farm in a friendly kind of manner, and it's a farming nation and sent most of its exports to Britain, 80% of them. But the European Economic Community, they were interested in developing local European farms to the exclusion of Britain's wider territories. And so that cut New Zealand out completely. So a lot of problems started from that. Britain's realignment to and focus on joining the European Union club, so to speak, and ditching the empire to do so. As Mr. Armstrong called it at the time, Britain's joining of the EU was a tragic date, a date of ominous potentialities. And that really was the case right away for New Zealand. Following Britain's joining of the European community, it began the process of souring relations between New Zealand and Britain.
Okay, so that was nearly 50 years ago. What do you see happening more recently that has severed that link?
Sure. Well, in the years that followed, obviously New Zealand needed to find new trading partners to be able to survive. The New Zealand dollar took a big hit. The inflation was skyrocketing at points in the 70s and 80s, up to, I believe, 20%. And so New Zealand needed to find a new trading partner. New Zealand's standard of living was going down. It used to be the third in the world, third best standard of living. I think that was in the 50s. And then by the 70s, it had dropped to 22nd place. So its standard of living in comparison to other countries was plummeting. So New Zealand needed to find another partner, and they found it in China. Now, the Chinese Communist Party had actually been developing a link with New Zealand's own minority Communist Party. And I don't think that was widely known at the time, but when the main government of New Zealand decided that, okay, China's going to be a good, willing customer for our products, they can keep our nation afloat, gradually those ties between China and New Zealand became closer and closer and closer to where today, conversely, compared to Britain back in the 1940s, where Britain took 80% of our trade, more than any other nation, today you have China on top taking, I believe it's 32% of New Zealand's trade, of New Zealand's exports. and which in and of itself is double that of the next highest country. I think today for Britain, it's only 2.5% compared to 80%. Mm-hmm. But China taking 32% and then New Zealand importing most of its goods from China, again, double that of the next highest nation. So you've got New Zealand really interweaving itself into China. And so at the start, there's a lot of pleasantries in the 80s and on into the 90s. But then the more and more integrated you get, the less and less freedom New Zealand has to be able to decide the way they want this relationship to go, or to have the freedom to do this or that. China becomes the real dominant leader in this partnership.
Yeah. We were talking with Callum Wood about the same story playing out in Australia, and he was describing how the Chinese have actually gained a considerable amount of leverage over Australian politicians, that they've actually used that to punish Australia if they take he was talking specifically about inquiries into the origins of the coronavirus, and China just immediately pounced on that, and it just shows the political leverage that they've gained. Do you see a similar situation in New Zealand?
Exactly the same story. I'm less familiar with the Australian situation, naturally, but I know in America you've got your Hunter Biden China situation,
right,
over there, and just times that by 10 in New Zealand. You've got so many MPs, members of parliament from both sides. So there's the, like in America, like in other countries, there's the two main parties, a sort of conservative party, so-called, the National Party, and then the more liberal party, the Labour Party. And across the spectrum, you've got leaders bought out by China. And the method China seems to be taking is setting up various banks in New Zealand and then appointing New Zealand MPs as leaders of those banks. So to rattle off a few, you've got several national MPs, Ruth Richardson, Chris Tremaine, Jenny Shipley, all of these leading figures who are chairmen of various Chinese banks in New Zealand. You've got a national MP. So this is supposedly the Conservative Party. This MP, he's a Chinese citizen. He came to New Zealand, became a New Zealand citizen. This wasn't actually known at the time, but this MP worked with Chinese military intelligence for 15 years.
Wow.
And somehow he became an MP for the Conservative Party in New Zealand. I think you've got the last three or four prime ministers of New Zealand, ex-prime ministers, that are now directly or indirectly working with Chinese banks or Chinese projects.
Boy.
It's pretty jaw-dropping. So these people are right in China's pocket, and yeah, can be blackmailed however they want.
So how has that relationship with China influenced or complicated New Zealand's alliances with the other English-speaking nations?
Well, it's made things very uncomfortable, to say the least. So naturally, New Zealand's alliances have been with the Anglo-Saxon countries, the US, Britain, Australia, Canada. And altogether, they make up they make up certain alliances, like the Five Eyes, which is an intelligence organization started in World War II. And so this is a very elite group of nations. Many other nations have wanted to join this intelligence grouping, but it's strictly, since World War II, remained the US, UK, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Well, big news happening earlier this year. New Zealand's foreign minister decided that actually we're a bit uncomfortable in this alliance, and we're not too sure how much we'll play into this alliance, because it's putting pressure on China, and we don't want to put pressure on China. And the US and some of these other countries are wanting to pressure China a little bit over their human rights issues, especially with the Uyghurs, the situation with the Uyghur genocide, really. And New Zealand doesn't want to be a part of that. And you have these other alliances as well, the more recent AUKUS, Australia, UK, US alliance. If anything would be a good thing for New Zealand to join, it would be that, right? New Zealand's right there with Australia. But New Zealand has distanced itself from that alliance, doesn't want to be a part of that alliance, because that alliance is directly designed as a check on China in the Pacific. So you've got a lot of uncomfortable situations that have happened and that are just going to happen more and more as New Zealand really becomes more and more closely linked with China.
We're running out of time here, but if you would, tell us about your current prime minister.
Okay, our current prime minister, Jacinda Ardern. She is a young, fresh-faced female prime minister. She was elected in 2017, not with the majority that international media made it to seem like. There was a parliamentary issue that meant that she did end up winning, even though she got less votes. But she is a socialist through and through, self-declared socialist. I mean, formerly a DJ, she was also president of the International Union of Socialist Youth, if that tells you anything. She's directly come out as a socialist and talked about the failure of capitalism in various avenues. And she really is a proponent of a lot of liberal issues. She pushed forward the legalization of abortion in New Zealand. She was pro-legalization of cannabis. But she's really come to the fore in international media surrounding the reaction to the COVID pandemic. She's really come out with a strong hand and shuttered everything pretty much from the start of 2020. New Zealand's international borders are still locked down for the foreseeable future. I've seen one source say till at least April 2022, when fully vaccinated travelers might be able to get in. So she really has locked down the country really strictly in order to try and enforce a COVID zero policy, which now has been given up on, really, the COVID zero mindset that they've admitted in New Zealand. We just can't maintain this. So they're continuing to have that complete lockdown of New Zealand's borders while trying to have a managed situation within. But she's a socialist. She's a big proponent of big government. And you can really see that with the way she's responded and micromanaged this coronavirus outbreak.
If you could just button it up with your view of what's happening to New Zealand in light of the prophecies of the Bible.
Sure. Well, New Zealand's rise was in tandem with Britain. And as I'm sure you've talked about with the other interviews, the result of those promised blessings to Britain. So the rise was in tandem with Britain and the fall was in direct tandem with Britain. As Britain's fallen over the past several decades, so has New Zealand. And world history isn't the story of little republics making it on their own, as much as the Republican movement in New Zealand would like to say. World history is the story of powerful empires controlling blocks of the world. And so the British Empire, it's gone, it's fallen. Okay, so what else do we have on the scene? We have the Chinese Empire growing. And so really New Zealand has become a part of a growing Chinese Empire. That's the long and the short of it, really, what the Bible talks about as the times of the Gentiles. And these are not kind empires. Britain had the greatest empire in world history. nothing developed like the British Empire, the most benevolent empire in world history, as much of a bad rap as people like to give it. But what is really scary is the idea of a Chinese empire or these other Gentile empires, like you saw in Germany, the Third Reich in World War II, just briefly. So you have this growing Chinese empire, and New Zealand really pivoting toward China and becoming entrapped in China. And so you have these warnings, of course, throughout the Bible, where God pleads with his people to return to him, and that growth of New Zealand strength will only finally come with the return of Christ, because there is no getting ourselves out of the situation physically. There's nothing New Zealand can do to get out of this situation without God's help. So we really need the return of Christ to bring that about.
Well, we appreciate that very much. We've been talking with trumpet writer and native New Zealander Chris Eames about the fall of New Zealand, part of the larger story of the fall of the English-speaking world. He's written an article for the coming print edition of The Trumpet that should be up at thetrumpet.com today. Thank you very much, Chris.
It's been a pleasure.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Think seriously about what we have been talking about on the program today regarding the fall of the English-speaking world. The rise of these peoples and their fall was prophesied more than 2,700 years ago. God recorded these prophecies, as the prophet Daniel put it, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomsoever he will. So God is able to crown and dethrone kings. He can make and unmake nations. He can raise up and destroy empires. God prophesied that the descendants of Abraham would become superpowers, the British Empire and the United States of America. And no one but God could make such great and such detailed prophecies and bring them to fulfillment across continents and across centuries. So the fact that this has actually taken place should profoundly affect your thinking and your life. This is the all-powerful God we're talking about. And he has specific warnings that he's trying to get across to us about what is about to happen to these nations. Did you know Jesus Christ was a prophet? He spoke detailed prophecies throughout his lifetime when he was on this earth. He inspired prophecies throughout the Bible. Revelation 19:10 says that the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy. A true Christian follows Christ. So a true Christian has the spirit of prophecy. Now you can look at the Olivet prophecy. This is his most important prophecy. It's recorded in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. And it was made by Jesus Christ himself when the disciples asked about the signs of his second coming and the end of the world. This is the answer that he gave them. Now, in Matthew 24, verses 21 to 22, he said, "For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be." This is the worst suffering in human history that's going to unfold just before his second coming. And verse 22 in the Moffat translation says, "Had not these days been cut short, not a soul would be saved alive." Now, of course, when he uttered this prophecy 2,000 years ago, men were fighting with swords and spears, but he said their time was coming that would threaten human extinction. And we live in the time when weapons are capable of just that. Not until our day has that been possible. Christ described this coming period of incomparable misery with a term that puzzles a lot of people. But if you understand what we've been talking about, it makes perfect sense in Luke's version of the Olivet prophecy. It says, when you shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know the desolation thereof is nigh. These be the days of vengeance, that all these things which are written may be fulfilled. So he says everything, every one of these prophecies about end time Israel is going to be fulfilled. It says they shall fall by the edge of the sword and shall be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. So he's talking about that period of tribulation just before his return, and he called it the times of the Gentiles. Chris Eames talked about that in the interview with him. Most people think Israel refers to the Jews, and that would make all non-Jews Gentiles. Now, it's true that Israel includes the Jewish nation in the Middle East, but as we've been talking about, the name Israel most aptly applies to America and Britain. The Gentiles are the non-Israelite peoples. This is a core biblical prophecy right out of Christ's mouth, and the dramatic fall of the English-speaking nations that the world is witnessing right now is a horrendous warning. The Israelite nations are falling, Gentile nations are taking charge right now, and it shows that we are in the outer edges of this catastrophic storm of which Jesus Christ forewarned us. This forecast of the worst suffering in human history parallels one from the prophet Jeremiah. He said, "Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble." So he called it Jacob's trouble. That shows it is directly directed primarily against the modern descendants of Israel because of our national sins. When this prophecy is fulfilled completely, all three of those Israelite nations, the United States, Britain, and the Jewish state, are going to be destroyed and enslaved and replaced by two new superpowers, each with a lot of strong allies. One is led by Germany, the other is led by Russia and China. These Gentile powers will clash in the worst war ever on earth. Britain lost its global power after World War II. America is now rapidly surrendering its power, and to fill the void, Gentile powers are rising. Christ said that this would be a time where men's hearts were failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. That's in Luke's version of the Olivet prophecy. But the very next verse says, then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. The fantastic news is that these times of the Gentiles will be very short, and they lead directly to the return of Jesus Christ. And he's going to put down these powers so that they are no longer able to destroy. This is a terrifying prophecy in some ways, but it is also a hope-filled prophecy, and it really gives us a sense of what lies ahead, and it prods us to make urgent use of the few days that we have left. This same God who warns of these punishments and this correction, he also tells us of where it's all ultimately leading. This is the powerful God of prophecy. He promises to send his Son to establish his kingdom on earth, install a perfect government that will bring prosperity, peace, and joy to people all over the world. That is no fantasy. That is a sure prophecy from the all-powerful living God.
It's time for today's last word.
Scientists have spent 24 years and $10 billion on the latest space telescope, the successor to the Hubble telescope. This is the James Webb Space Telescope. Its launch date has been delayed many times. It was originally scheduled to launch in 2007, but it is now at the launch site in French Guiana, and it is scheduled to rocket into space this Friday, December 24th, 6:20 a.m. Central Standard Time. This telescope is many times more impressive than Hubble, which is very impressive. The bigger a telescope's mirror, the more powerful the telescope. Hubble has 48 square feet of mirror. James Webb has 273 square feet. This mirror has 18 hexagonal segments made of gold-plated beryllium. And the amazing thing is that it's even lighter than the mirror on the Hubble telescope. The individual components on this telescope are phenomenal. It will capture images of a whole range of the light spectrum, mostly on the infrared side of the spectrum, which is very helpful since the universe is expanding, which causes redshift. So most stuff out there is going to be on the infrared part of the light spectrum. And so this telescope will show us things outside the visible portion of the light spectrum, things we've never seen before. It will enable us to see through the dust clouds and the things that obscure our view from those Hubble images to see light from much farther away, much further back in time. If you haven't seen images and animations of how this telescope works, do yourself a favor and find one. It has to fire into space in a rocket, so everything is folded up and then it must unfold. It has to automatically assemble itself in space. And this will be happening as it travels to its orbital resting place about 1 million miles out there in space, the perfect position for simply staying put, orbiting around the sun. And it's very dark out there. It's ideal for looking out into space, but it is exposed to the sun. The temperatures there will hit 185 degrees Fahrenheit. And the componentry on the telescope needs extreme cold to operate properly. So they've made a 5-layer sun shield made of silicon and aluminum coated Kapton. It's the size of a tennis court. Layer 1 always has the sun shining on it. Layer 5 is always in the shade. And there is a 600 degree difference between these two. The cold side is 388 degrees below zero. The Hubble telescope has had 5 missions to service and repair it, but it's only 335 miles away from the surface of the Earth. James Webb will be way too far out there to visit it. So once it launches, it is on its own. So everything has to be perfect the first time. This is one of the most complex advanced engineering projects in human history. One man who's very familiar with all the science, he said, "There's nothing I can say that can come close to describing how technically difficult this telescope is. We are at the verge of impossible." The telescope failed a test in March 2018, and a review board found that the telescope had 344 potential single point failures, any one of which could doom the project. Every one of these operations has to happen perfectly without fail the first time. This project is the product of stunning ingenuity. It's a testament to the fact that God made us in His image and likeness. He gave us godlike powers of intellect and reason. It's also a testament to how lawful and orderly the universe is. Scientists devise this technology. They know exactly how to position this telescope, how it's going to function 1 million miles away from Earth. And that's all because there is a lawgiver. It's also a stunning expression of man's fascination with the universe. Man has wanted to know about space throughout our history, like King David sitting out in the sheepfold contemplating the heavens. God went to a lot of trouble to make sure that we would be able to see what's going on out there because He wants us contemplating the cosmos. Personally, I hope and pray this telescope works. If it does, in fact, launch on Friday, it'll take a month to reach its home. The instruments won't turn on until 2 to 3 months after the launch. Science won't really start until about 6 months after launch. So it might not be until next summer that we start seeing pictures from James Webb. And of course, that's only if everything goes exactly right. But is it possible God is behind this project because He wants to expand our understanding of the universe He created? Maybe He delayed it to this time to make it all the more inspiring when this comes out. You think about all of the events taking place in the world right now and just how insane this coming year is going to be. And imagine as all of that is happening and the world is just falling apart, pictures coming out regularly from the James Webb Telescope, revealing things about the universe we never knew. The more we see, the more we learn about God, and the sharper becomes our vision of our awesome universe potential. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Callum Wood and Chris Eames. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Theodore Roosevelt. Keep your eyes on the stars and your feet on the ground. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.